Your folks.
No.
Okay.
That's.
Oh. Are those your cushions?
Which?
The ones I pushed. For
the... That's okay.
Okay. Go get some. You're not gonna last.
There was a couple here.
Okay. Unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect Dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning, everybody. We're just going to do a little tech, more tech here. We'll see who's here. I can see you. Yeah, hello. Okay. And between Martin and Carmen, if my voice drops, I expect gyrations, and it might take quite a bit because I get focused in on computers. So. And it's such a gorgeous day here. Hopefully it is wherever you are. So we're going to continue on with our series of the Bodhisattva Paramitas. And this week we are at meditation. So we've gone through generosity, ethics, patience, vigor, or joyful effort. And so now we land on meditation. And those of you who have been following the series, you know, like faithfully with every single, you know, you'll know that Michael gave us a primer on meditation. So there'll be some, was it? Nope, sorry, Kate. Whoa! There goes a mark. On that. So there'll be some overlap, and there'll be some, maybe not so much overlap. So, but... So certainly there's sort of the usual, you know, and Dhanya is used for the fifth perfection or paramita. And it refers to the practice of settling and focusing the mind. So the English word for meditation is to think deeply, to reflect. And for Buddhas, samadhi means concentration, focus, single-pointedness, non-distraction. The word describes a state of mind rather than a technique or practice, the result of disciplined meditation rather than its exercise. So we have some of the expressions or what this means in other kind of Buddhist descriptions, the Dharma gate of repose and bliss, where you're focusing your attention, becoming tranquil, deeply contemplating, silent stillness and illumination, which is usually the image we have when we look up at our Buddhas, and looks pretty good. But that's not really usually what we always think of. We also might not think with the way we're the North American perspective on, you know, even though the paramitas isn't really sequenced, it is, and so meditation falls into the number fifth, so it's sort of surprising that it's not the first one. That's probably because of our contemporary views around mindfulness and meditation, especially in the last 10 or 20 years, where mindfulness meditation is being used for all sorts of treatments and therapies and anxiety and mind states, lowering blood pressure, illness, curiosity, altered states of consciousness, or even that sense that there's something missing in your life. So I think that, you know, like I said, for the average kind of contemporary just bopping along there, not from like looking at it from a bodhisattva, you'd think it would come first because that's what we tend to do. But in their wisdom, I guess, would be the best way to put it. And from the Bodhisattva perspective, meditation is in that class. I think last time I talked about generosity, ethics, patience, joyful effort. And it depended on which pivot point you looked at, but that we were moving into a pivot point, that some of the first paramitas were kind of considered more or less ordinary, that anybody would do it, and that the others were more emphasis on what monks and nuns might practice. But it's certainly, from a Bodhisattva perspective, there's certainly a little bit more going on with that. And so the fifth and sixth paramitas are considered different in that they require a more spiritual frame of reference, and they require more effort. There's more of a push in comparison to, that's the suggestion. We get some images of the great tripod of ethical conduct, meditation, and understanding as being a tripod of enlightenment. Though it kind of contradicts a little bit on what we're doing, because those aren't the ones we've been doing per se. And then I thought, well, there's sort of another tripod. There's generosity, patience, ethical conduct. And then you could start maybe layering, you know, now you've got a nice good stool, and then you can put, you know, the rest of them on top. That might be another tripod. So it just depends on who you look at and which way you understand it. But that all of these things, including our wheel, one supports the other. And they also, this is Wright, talks about kind of subtle qualities of the character, where the first paramita seem more active, and that meditation maybe not so much, but not true. It's a very active process, and it's set of personal qualities that can be cultivated through meditative practices. Who else do we have here? We've got Reb chiming in with trying to attain concentration without practicing the first four paramitas. That's what he's chosen. That without it, we're not ready to relax and let go of our thinking. And with it, we can develop trust that we can both let go of our thinking and be responsible at the same time, and be able to fully embrace the Bodhisattva vow. And that the kind of the promise, I guess, for lack of it, follows naturally, the Bodhisattva tranquility follows naturally from the first four perfections. It's open, undistracted, flexible, and calm. So we have definitions of kind of that on what's going on with meditation, things on purpose of meditation, so that, you know, certainly you don't have to be long in Buddhism to kind of pick up on the fact that meditation is pretty primary in the quest for Buddhist enlightenment. Meditation, this is according to Wright, was traditionally considered the most effective ways of dealing with the three poisons, greed, aversion, and delusion, evading hindrances, like sensual desire, ill will, tiredness, laziness, depression, and doubt. It's also good for letting go of discursive thoughts. We'll talk about that a little bit later. We get into an even more classic, Nagaguna. I can't read. You know who I mean. I'm so bad at languages. So it's, I think there's some nice imagery here with this, you know, this is analogous to a burning lantern, the purpose of meditation. Although the lantern is capable of providing illumination, it cannot be useful in a stiff breeze. However, if one places it in a closed room, its usefulness then becomes completely manifest. And then there's another one here. It is through being neither mentally distracted nor indulgent of enjoyment that one should perfect Dhanya Paramita. This is analogous to when one takes medicine to tend to the body, and as an expedite sets aside household responsibilities. When one's energy and strength return to their normal healthful state, then one takes up one's work again, just as before. The bodhisattva's indulgence and stillness is just like this. They employ the power of dānya absorption to ingest the medicine of wisdom and then gains the power of the super knowledges. Big. And then I did come some of these things, just in case you found yourself achieving one. Her powers. The divine eye through which the body sought for can see suffering beings far away as well as activities in other worlds. The divine ear through which the bodhisattva can hear calls for assistance as well as the Dharma being preached anywhere in the universe. Knowledge of our minds. That's a good one. Remembrance of previous births and magical powers. And they don't define magical powers. They just sort of... And then Norman talks about this too, you know, infinite space, infinite consciousness, such nothingness, neither perception or non-perception. So, like I said with the other one, we're not going there, but just in case you might want to know. Okay, so. I think Diane Rizzotto's perhaps a better, it's a more concise on what we're doing with this paramita is that up until then we've been centered on how we engage in action with the world in which we live. And now we turn towards silent stillness in the presence of whatever conditions are arising. It invites us to train in the skill of saying yes to each moment. And this is back to meditation as an activity. And it's not about getting somewhere, but being where we are, greeting ourselves, arriving at our own door. I like that. She talks about, and I think this is sort of that contemporary thing on how we come to meditation, you know, so, and certainly for most of us, it's been through a lot of different roads and channels, and that it doesn't matter why or when or how we began, it's just that we've arrived. She attributes this to Zen, but I think this is all meditation, crowns us in stillness and openness, awareness of the present moment. And it's from this mind we can meet the world and take wise action. But most of us, might be a few that didn't, but what we first notice is the busyness of our mind and body, active thinking, squirmy body or emotional energy. And so then we have to come up with strategies on how do we manage all of that. So that's when we are introduced to different types of techniques. And not so much in the Zen world, but certainly out there, and we do use it though, but looking on objects or other techniques like breathing, feeling, sensations, phrases, sounds, choiceless awareness, all sorts of things like that. And the Buddhist kind of overreaching though, there's kind of two major categories. And Kate talked about this too. But we have the calming tranquility practice, so samatha. And we have insight or vipassana, which is self-explanatory. So calming is focusing, you know, allowing us to stabilize and focus the mind. Usually begins with mindfulness breathing. And it's a high level of composure and focus achieved when that does happen. That's sort of the, you know, direction of samadhi or concentration. And so basic techniques are bringing the mind to the object of concentration and patiently training it through repetition to stay with the object. Not easy to do, says Norman. The mind wanders and strays, gets tired and distracted. And you're impressed with how little control you have. And then insight, the vipassana, entails a cultivation of thinking and giving rise to enlightened wisdom. That's Wright's talking. But basically, the seeing things the way things really are. Our reality is present to the human. That our existence is impermanent, lacking in self or inner essence, or unsatisfactory. In the process of this meditation, the practitioner undertakes an analytical investigation the perceived world themselves and the perceived world by following formulas. That's another way. And then Norman talks about, I think that it might sit more familiar to us on mindfulness and insight. Is being aware with some clarity and calmness all the time, not just when we're doing formal meditation on the cushion or reading or listening or reciting teachings. And just as concentration practice isn't concentration per se, but concentration for the purpose of spiritual development. And just as insight practice isn't just insight per se, but insight with a profound healing purpose. So mindfulness is more than just being aware. You can be aware without being mindful. And for the Bodhisattva, mindfulness is the effort to be aware of our deeper life, our connection to others, and to all being. Or sati, to remember or recollect. So, Kate, you did get into a lot of the Zen categories and styles, you know, and in the back and forth with that. So I'm not going to get into it too much, but we traditionally have the Rinzai style koan practice to meditate on short story or a phrase, and the Soto Zen practice, which is simply sitting in meditation. But certainly if you've hung around Mountain Rain, you know that we do a little bit of everything on that, and so that we're not fixed on that. But it's not our predominant style on that. And certainly, I love the stuff that Norman talks about. You know, and certainly sitting meditation isn't just unique to Soto Zen. It goes across everything, but we seem to do a special emphasis on it. And then the other thing that he points out, which most of you will have figured out, is that what's most remarkable about all forms of Zen meditation is how little instruction is provided. You'd think a school name for the practice of meditation would offer detailed instruction. And we don't. We've got a few that we do. We know that, but not pounds and volumes of it. And then I kind of noticed what he was talking about, that I kind of consider not helpful images when you kind of, you know, might put you off a little bit, you know, like the gateless barrier. Make your whole body a mass of doubt with all your 60 bones and joints and your 84,000 hair follicles. Concentrate on the word moo night and day, digging into it. It's like swallowing a red hot iron ball. You try to vomit it out, but you can't. Okay. You know. And then they kind of throw it too, where they kind of throw in that you don't need to practice meditation. We're already there. Okay. And yet, you know, if there's a hair's breadth deviation, it's like the gap between heaven and earth. If the least like or dislike arises, the mind is lost in confusion. Okay. The Buddha didn't meditate to become awakened and end his suffering. He meditated because he was already awakened. So that's for higher, more esoteric discussion. That's where I'm going to put that, personally. Because I'm kind of a basic, pragmatic girl. The one discussion, though, is on the things that catch us up. And there's lots of discussions on hindrances, you know, and what gets in the way. So, and those are useful categories to ponder. So attachment, obsession with thoughts and memories, sensations or images, aversion, obsessive complaining, the desire to flee, flurry and worry, body jumping around all over the place, dragging up things to be concerned about, doing anything not to stay within the object of concentration, laziness, being sleepy, unmotivated, thus unable to return to the object for lack of interest, doubt, wondering what's the point of doing all of this, frustrating and boring work. That's Norman. You can hear Norman there. And when any of these are present, we can't concentrate. So our practice involves identifying them and patiently working through them. It can occur anytime, so the ability to stay focused and not let them get the best of you. The other word, the term that comes up a lot too, is this dispersive of thoughts, which technically means wandering back and forth. And they include things like patterns of thinking that include planning, logical reasoning, argumentation, intuition, imagination, daydreaming, night dreaming, and all sorts of wandering thoughts. When one is able to let go of discursive thought moment after moment for some time, the effort that comes to fruition is calm abiding. That's if you're wondering. I think this is more key. That some think concentration practice involves suppressing discursive thoughts, aka thinking. It's more accurate to say that concentration follows from generously letting go of disturbed thought. When one is able to let go of disturbed thought moment after moment for some time, that effort comes to fruition to calm abiding again. In bodhisattva meditation, thinking is not illuminated and it's not grasped. And so it's that more of that sense of allowing rather than shoving it out. I still personally find that still all of what I just said, that's all the books, was still a little more esoteric. What I do like is how Wright explains it. And it's part of, obviously he's a scholar, but of the image of layering, and I too, you'll see, and that there are three layers of awareness when it comes to meditation, and you'll see. So the first layer is immediate and direct. Direct awareness of some appearance, internal or external, things like hearing sounds, seeing objects, smelling fragrances, tasting flavors, feeling the tactile character of our world. At the first level, experiences such as smelling ripe fruit, feeling hungry, realizing I forgot my reading glasses, all of these are immediate. They just come and go in the most, almost always moving stream of consciousness. But in Buddhist meditation theory begins with our critique or exploration of the quality of this immediate lived experience. The mind moves rapidly from one focal point to another. I have no say in the matter, and I just follow the scenes as they unfold. Unmeditative, we do not notice the state of distraction. And then we get into Diane Rosetto. And then you can start seeing why I'm liking this part. What's most important is not the position of our body, but the stillness and intimacy of mind and body within that position. Our body embodies awareness, and awareness embodies the body. And we start to learn that even the slight unconscious shift of a muscle will change the mind's perception, even with the slightest shift in the mind's focus will cause the body to move. With it so subtle, we go about our daily activities. We don't tend to notice these reciprocal effects. But as we sit in silence, we can begin to notice some of these subtle shifts in holding. The letting go I speak of is not, however, permission to scratch an itch here or try and shift bodies for greater comfort, but rather a stepping back as we realize our holding in to simply observing what is present without trying to change or fix it. This, of course, is easier said than done. But that's that, where we're finally, and like I've said that at the beginning, there's not a lot of discussion about, you know, they say everything's through the body, but again, where in the body and how. And so then it makes sense that things like that follow using breathing, the practice of conscious breathing, and calming types of meditation make it possible to renew our attention to our bodily experience. Which flows, there's a continuity of mind and body that's always in effect, regardless of our lack of awareness. But meditation opens the possibility this continuity can be consciously developed and enhanced. Meditation makes it clear to us how much influence the body has on the mind and how significant a role the mind has to play on our physical selves. When the integration of mind and body is cultivated, there's a heightened experience of both. So, changing my mind here about some things. Reb, I've sort of had this as an interlude about body and posture and breathing. And it was sort of between the two layers of direct awareness and the next layer. And he talks about respecting the body and mind. And I think that's, you know, I kind of see that as the experience on our cushion. When we're trying to, you know, figure out all of this stuff and learn various techniques or just learn to sit. And I like this perspective. When we're consciously attending to the body, we do it with tenderness and care. And our mind are simultaneously transformed in a way that's conducive. By expressing kindness for our limited body and mind, we open to a concentration that realizes unlimited perceptible Buddha and body and mind. And this is more with using and being aware of physical discomfort and starting to even use that as the beginning of the practice, so that I know from experience, for example, there might be an ache that will not damage me, but I know that if I don't change, it'll be uncomfortable, but if I'm tensing, I'm doing a change that's not supportive or relaxing with it. And then there's the pains that are harmful, and allowing to adjust accordingly. And then there's just the trial and error on what you think you can hold with, what you can sit with, what you need to adjust. And I think mostly that point of that is just that interjecting that, especially when we get into concentration practices and meditation and sitting still. And obviously this is kind of where I've been going with a lot of this, is that trying to figure out that edge or that balance on becoming still, but not so, you know, not at the price of complete and utter pain, or not at the price of where you're so distracted you can't do anything, right? So the second layer is reflective thinking, which goes beyond direct awareness. And Wright's explanation is on how to look at that. It's the difference between the first layer and the second layer is that on the first layer, you might be doing things like, there's a lake, or I'd like to buy those pastries. It's just some sort of thought. But at the second layer, my mind stands back from that immediate sense and questions. Am I right? This is a lake, or maybe it's a bay, or maybe it's a mirage. Or given the price, my diet, do I really need or want those pastries? Probably yes, but don't listen. But it's just this mental tools of critical thinking, deliberate choices, looking at alternatives, looking to think critically, just sort of things that you take a look at. And that's the second layer. And there's different ways of doing that. And both Diane and Norman talk about this on noting thoughts and emotions, and some will do labeling, but they both kind of subscribe to this sensory awareness or feeling sensation. And that we start to notice that emotion thoughts always have an accompanying sensory experience, whether or not we're awake to it. And so this kind of insight, this is Norman verbatim, is not easy to come by. Feeling sensation is barely conscious, barely available as an experience period to access. and I need to do more than think and observe in the usual way. But insight that's fully integrated with concentration, practice in all its somatic body, depth is more than a thought or understanding. It pervades body, mind, and heart. It transforms emotions, physical sensations, and thoughts. It's the foundation of a new identity. That's why meditation has always been an essential element in Buddhist project of bringing an end to our ordinary human suffering. He gets into, I'm not going to do the stuff about conscious awareness and it's a vipassana, you know, the tragedy of consciousness entering a partial world, reacting to a partial world. And that sort of, in, that part of it is this going from non-aware to being partially aware. And then once you're aware, you can make some choices with this partial world. The third layer is self-awareness. Nobody did much on that category because I think it's quite, again, very esoterical, but that's when you're getting in the beyond on your insight about what impermanence, non-self, dukkha. The mind bends back and awareness of itself evolved. The self is ungraspable. And so I'm just going to put it there. That's where it was. I think it's a nice layer. But again, I'm not so sure if that would be one's major ambition, for lack of a better word, while on the cushion. So, but again, like the others, if you come across it, that's what you're doing. I listed a kind of a fourth unofficial layer, which both lots of people have talked about is around the imagination, and I didn't know where it would fall, but it seemed to be an important one to access. And acts of imagination open up the mental space in which we envision possibilities, gazing beyond what is toward what could be. It opens the question of the good or the better in our minds. And it's not the same as fantasizing or daydreaming. Imagination in its most creative and productive forms is a discipline practice. And this is what qualifies it as a form of meditation. The discipline of imagination also presupposes a commitment to the truth conditions that shape our lives. Now I looked at, and it was interesting that I looked at some of my non-Buddhist texts and perspectives, and again, I'm being quite verbatim with a lot here, but I actually like the way, and it's going to be three authors that have articulated probably what aligns mostly with what I feel about this practice and what we're doing with body and meditation. So David Emerson and Elizabeth Hopper, you know, and this is talking about what's going on outside of the Buddhist worlds and what's happening in the scientific world, psychology world, and that we know these worlds are coming together and overlapping. So Emerson talks about one of the profound lessons from contemporary neuroscience research is our sense of ourselves is anchored in vital connection with our bodies. The neuroscientist Antonio Damasio has shown that an area of the brain called the insula is the place that transmits bodily sensations into conscious awareness. That means that consciousness is fundamentally a product of how we interpret the physical sensations we experience. I like that. Bessel van der Kolk, leading expert on body awareness and trauma. The body keeps the score, guy. Body awareness puts in touch with our inner world, the landscape of our organism. When we pay focused attention to our bodily sensations, we can recognize the ebb and flow of our emotions, and with that, increase our control over them. Allowing your mind to focus on your sensations and notice, in contrast to the timeless, ever-present experience of suffering, Physical sensations are transient and respond to slight shifts in body position, changes in breathing, and shifts in thinking. And then mindfulness, of course, and we've talked about this, and breath is calming the sympathetic nervous system. And then Robert Augustus Masters, he's written a book about spiritual bypassing. And I think this is very succinct and encapsulates. To really feel our body is an art in which compassion, patience, and the spirit of exploration all coexist. Getting back into the body does not mean abandoning our intellect, but rather in allowing it to synergistically coexist with the social, somatic, emotional, spiritual, moral, aesthetic, and survival dimensions of intelligence. Getting back to the body is not a backward step. It's an opportunity to return to full-blooded embodiment now. And now centered not by ego, but by intrinsic awareness. And now in which the personal, interpersonal, and transpersonal are in a fitting embrace. An essential part of becoming more embodied is not just witnessing, but feeling our body, both externally and internally, with unmuddled attention, not from an intellectual or compartmentalized distance, or from a supposedly higher or ascended consciousness, but directly letting awareness and sensation fully meet. To really feel our body is an art in which compassion, patience, in the spirit of exploration all coexist. The body is not a burden with which we've been saddled, nor is it an obstruction to realizing our true nature. Whatever its wrapping, our body is a gift. And so his layers, this is how I saw it. When lost in thought, we have no body. When attention is brought to thought, we have a body. When attention is brought to sensation, we shift from having a body to being in a body. When attention is brought to perception, we shift from being in a body to being present as a body. When attention is brought to our overall presence, our innate wholeness of being, we shift from being present as a body to simply being, neither separate from nor identified with our body. And I thought that really, I was kind of flipping through. I was just like, whoa. That says kind of what the others say, but I find that a little more accessible personally. So some of the, you know, and then we have others, you know, so that, Kama sort of, she talks about cleaning up the house and opening the doors and the house we live in our body. It doesn't matter how many times we move from home to country or another, you know, the body keeps coming with us. And she says the same thing, knowing the feeling, not reacting and letting it go. So that's kind of what we're visiting over and over and over again. Okay. So we're going to move into this part two. And it might take a little longer because I'm going to actually look at three different mindfulness exercises, and I'll just transition them from one to the other. But I just sort of want to make sure you kind of were aware of that a little bit, that that's what's going on there. And so there'll be a little shifting. And it was just more to, just like I've been trying to just get that tasting of connecting sensations and to certain concepts, because this is meditation and we talk about different types of objects of meditations. I thought, well, let's just mess around a little bit with that, you know, and just see how that is experienced. So once again, like I said, we'll get ourselves comfortable while you guys must, you know, get your seats going. I'll just do some of the foundational stuff for anybody who hasn't come through with this. We know that this is definitely not standard Zazen meditation style, but it's just to offer a different perspective or view to your practice. Everything that we're doing is optional, and you can participate or not. If you want to turn off your screens, that's fine. If you want to find a different position, but you can tune me out or tune me in. And we're not trying to go with any deep dives here, but just to introduce and explore. So to begin, that ask you to find a comfortable position, whatever that is for you. And you'll just stay in that position as much as you feel comfortable with. So we'll just settle. Your eyes can be opened or closed. You might have your feet up or on a cushion. You might even be sitting in a classic Zazen position. Choose and give yourself permission to pick the most comfortable. And as you settle into your position, and as your body begins to ease, you may choose to take a cleansing type breath in and a deep breath out. Another breath in and another breath out. And if you want, just find a breath pattern that is calm and comfortable. And take a few minutes and cycles of breath in your own way. And then perhaps begin to be aware of the points of your body that are in contact with your cushion or your seat, soles of your feet on the floor, your back against your chair. Knees touching on each other. Just notice, be aware. There's nothing to notice, that's fine too. Now, the invitation will be to shift your attention to your breath. Notice the in-breath, notice the out-breath. Perhaps bring your attention to your breathing wherever you feel it the most. The nostrils, in your chest, in your belly. And when your mind wanders, gently return to the sensation of breathing. And as you breathe, perhaps let your awareness move deeply into the experience of breathing. Perhaps be curious as to where your breath begins. And the sensation as it travels from your nose, your throat, to your upper airways, mid airways, lower airways, the expansion of the ribs moving out, belly rising, oxygen moving into your bloodstream, into all parts of your body. And then maybe be curious about how your breath releases. Moves away from the lower, middle, upper parts of your breathing apparatus. Or maybe the gap between exhalation and the next inhalation. And where your sense of spaciousness may come. And in your own way, continue for a few cycles of mindfulness of breath. And now the invitation will be to consider sound as an object of concentration. Allow your awareness to receive sound vibrations in whatever form they may present. You might consider the sounds that are immediately close to you, or even inside of you. Or sounds in the room, or a few feet away. Or perhaps you're noticing sounds that are coming from the outside, outside your building, on the street, or even further away, rooftops, trees, sky. You don't need to label the sounds, and you don't need to keep your attention with any particular sound. Just hear whatever presents itself to you. And when you notice your mind has wandered away on a train of thought, simply return to the task of listening. And maybe consider how you're listening. With your ears, your body, your skin, maybe your whole being. Finally, imagine a sense of illumination within your body center, wherever you define your center. Perhaps visualizing the glow of a single candle flame, softly flickering, steady, or a soft orb of light, more diffuse. When your mind wanders, bring it ever so gently back to that light in your center. And then maybe allow that light illumination to expand from your heart space to your mind space throughout your entire body. Now let the light travel outside of yourself to others in the room, to the next building, the next town, or country, and the entire world. Visualize yourself and your entire surroundings suffused with warm, radiant light. A poem, Dana Foles, Being Present. Breathe, relax, and feel. Take time to slow down the pace of life. Watch the rise and fall of moods, the birth and death of dreams. Feelings and sensations seem so real, yet they shift like changing clouds and flow with the high tide out to sea again. Allow it all to be, no need to grasp or push away. Present with each moment, the whole of you, body, mind, and soul, opens to receive. Breathe, relax, and feel. Take time to slow down the pace of life. Watch the rise and fall of moods, the birth and death of dreams. Feelings and sensations seem so real, yet they shift like changing clouds and flow with the high tide out to sea again. Allow it all to be, no need to grasp or push away. Present with each moment, the whole of you, body, mind, and soul, opens to receive.
Do a little better thing. Here we go. Just in case. We'll just bring you back.
Just take your time. Don't move too quickly. So I realized I never planned any homework. I thought, oh well. I don't know about you. Sometimes I do it, sometimes I don't. So, but maybe just off the cuff, you could take a look at meditation under a different perspective a little bit for yourself. Maybe consider the layers, you know, and that as an approach. Or a different object of meditation. There's lots to pick. Breath is the popular one, but there are lots of others, you know. And just see what happens with that. And then I borrow from kind of my yoga training on anything that we've done. Is there anything that we've done or you've noticed that can inform your practice in your day-to-day? So just awareness of awareness or sounds or what you do with it, you know, just anything like that. It doesn't have to be big. Probably shouldn't be big. I would lean toward just make it small on that. And then, of course, because I know you're so diligently practiced, I can't send you home with meditation as practice. So, I guess I could, but you know, I would send you home with maybe reframing and thinking about what you might be doing with yourself on that cushion that could just be maybe a little kinder to your body, a little kinder to your mind, and maybe borrow from concepts like a little cross training. It's okay to borrow from some other. We don't just have to do just Zazen hardcore the same way, like in a really narrow sense with the three instructions, but whatever way is comfortable. That's about all I can think of. I personally, each paramita, I've come up with a little animal creature, and I didn't come up with one with this one for me, so that's probably why I forgot the homework part, but you can feel free to use your imagination with that. And I thank you for coming. We'll go and we'll hopefully do the right chant this time. Last week we did.
That's on page three.
Okay, may our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Inexhaustible, I vow to them. Your mind is are boundless, I vow to render them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.
Okay.
We'll be moving right into service.